I am especially concerned for parents of teens today. And it's I'm assuming you're here because either you will have teens one day or you have them now. Most of the time, people would come to something like this because they have teens. And it's a unique kind of seminar because people don't sit back casually. They're not hearing about real estate. Not hearing teachings on the gifts of the Holy Spirit. And so people tend to listen like this. And there tends to be a sense of urgency about it, because if you have teenagers in this day and age, there can be very challenging. What inspired me to even begin to teach anything on teens was a church reunion we went to this last summer. And we met some of our old friends we haven't seen in 10 or 12 years. And our children were born together and then grew up together. So at the time, they were about 4 or 5. And then we went off to plant a church, and we'd been out of the area. We got back together with these people. But it was so disconcerting, so difficult, so painful for my wife and I to see the different paths that our children had taken. And my wife and I were just distressed to see the parents whose children were rebellious and defiant, disrespectful, and just had a look about them of just contempt for authority. And my wife and I would talk to the parents, and they'd say, well, they're teens, what are you going to do? It's just part of growing up. And these parents had given up and kind of accepted that the children had to be in rebellion, had to be disrespectful, had to be defiant. I want to say to you tonight, that's a lie. They do not have to. This is the first century in the history of the world where there's been anything like teen rebellion. People have always been rebellious. This isn't human nature. But what we call teen rebellion, this part of growing up and gaining independence, that's what Christian psychologists or popular leaders, they have tried to give peace to parents, but it's a false peace. Because they say, oh, it's a phase, it's part of growing up, and as a result, parents have stopped putting, get this, effort into parenting. So it was when I left that reunion, I saw what was happening. I saw the philosophy that these parents had. It disturbed me, and I began to write within 3 or 4 weeks. I'd written 150 pages on a new book on parenting teens. I told someone, you know, that I was working on this book, and they said, well, wait a second, your oldest is 17 years old. You haven't finished your task yet. How can you write this? And I said, it's because I'm not writing from my experience. I'm writing from the Word of God. The Word of God has the authority. And it has been exciting for me to go to the Word and say, what does the Bible say about parenting teenagers? And actually, the Bible's full. And I had never done this research until this last summer after this experience. And I went to the Word to see how many times that teens, they're not called teenagers. They were called young adults living at home is what they were. Because you became an adult at 12. And so after that, if you lived at home, you were a young adult living at home. You were a single adult. And so there's plenty of illustrations in the Scriptures, which we'll cover tonight, that give us lessons about parenting teenagers. And this is good news, folks, because the Word of God is what we have to rely upon. It's a blueprint. In fact, that's really our first point for the evening. What are our reliable sources of parenting help? And I ask it in the plural, but I answer it in the singular. The Bible is our only reliable source of parenting help. This is important that we understand this. Much of what we do today is based on human wisdom. We must guard ourselves from human wisdom. Well, look what the Scripture says about human wisdom. In Psalm 1:1, it says that blessed is the man who does not walk, where? In the counsel of the ungodly. Those without God, those who don't follow Him, will offer counsel and advice that is dangerous. So we're blessed to avoid worldly counselors. Or, get this please, Christians who have been trained by worldly counselors. They're using human wisdom. In 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 19 to 20, says that human wisdom, actually, people lack true wisdom. In fact, he goes on in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 18 to 20, God calls human wisdom foolishness. So we look at ourselves and we say, well, wait a second, my parenting uses human wisdom and plus God's wisdom. I see God's wisdom wasn't sufficient. And so now we're well equipped because we add man's wisdom plus God's wisdom to come up with the ultimate wisdom. Boy, are we lucky. We've helped God out. No. Everything we need for life and godliness, 2 Peter chapter 1, verse 3 says, everything we need for life and godliness is wrapped up in our knowledge of God. This is our knowledge of God, the Bible. That is our knowledge of. That's how he's revealed himself. I can't emphasize enough. Tonight, I'm going to maybe stepping on some toes. You may be saying, wait a second. I don't know. That contradicts what I've heard. But listen to yourself. If you struggle with something I'm saying, say, but wait, but won't that? See, if I'm offering you my opinion, then you're free to disagree. But if I'm simply citing to you a biblical example, then don't challenge. Say, oh my goodness, I better set aside my opinion and cling to the Word. You see, the Word has the truth in it. And so if you find yourself struggling with things like that, because it will contradict some of your preconceived ideas, if you're going to resist, oh, let it only resist because you understand the Scripture differently. All right? So let's move on then. Our reliable source of parenting help is the Bible. God's wisdom is contained within His pages. And as a result, when we're going to evaluate our parenting ideas, we ask ourselves basic questions such as, does this parenting approach accomplish the goals for my child which God established in the Bible? In other words, will this bring my child to the fulfillment of the goals God has set laid out for me? We might also evaluate it by asking the question, is my parenting approach, the parenting idea, based strictly on principles of child rearing presented in the Word? And then we might ask, is it a parenting approach modeled by godly parents in the Bible? In other words, if you can't find what you're doing as a routine modeled by someone in the Scriptures, it should lay open to question why you're doing what you're doing. So, that being the case, that's our premise. We need to establish what God's goals are for parents of teens. He has goals for us, for any parents, quite honestly. He has many. Here's the primary goal we're going to deal with tonight. It's found in Ephesians chapter 6, verse 4. Talking to fathers about not exasperating their children, he says, but instead, bring them up in the training and instruction of the Lord. This word, ektrepho, means to rear up to maturity. So he's really saying, rear up your children to maturity in the training and instruction of the Lord. So we must have a goal, because if we lack it, we won't succeed with our parenting. This is, by the way, if you've been to my child training seminar or you've read the book, you're familiar with this principle, but if you've lacked it, let me just dwell on this a moment. Most parents do not have goals very specific for their children. They say, I want my kids to be nice, I want them to go to church, I want them to follow Christ, I want them to be godly, I want them to grow up, I want them to be mature, but they're not specifically sure what maturity is. And you ever heard the saying, if you aim at nothing, you'll always hit it? Yeah, if you aim at nothing, you'll always hit it. I discovered when I was an archer, as a young person, I loved archery. I loved to compete in tournaments. I discovered I could really hone my skills. Instead of aiming for the yellow circle, I'd aim for the very dead center of that. So I wouldn't just aim for the yellow. I'd aim for the very, very center. So if I was a little bit off, I was still in the yellow. You see, but I had a goal. It wasn't just, I think I'll hit that target someplace on that bale of hay. It was, I want to hit the dead center. So in our parenting, we must know exactly what we want our teens to become. And then, get this, we evaluate all that we do in our parenting decisions in terms of, will this accomplish these goals I have for my child? It's really a tremendous tool, but you've got to know what you're aiming your kids towards. And often our parenting, we blunder, we wander, because we don't have a specific goal for our children. So let's talk about this maturity. Let's define it. Once again, you may have heard this or read it in my book. But if you've missed it, listen carefully. What characterizes, well, let's, I'm going to bring that answer up in the overhead for you. God's basic goal for us as parents is to train children up to maturity. Now, here's the three elements of maturity. They're on your page there. Self-control, wisdom, and responsibility. I did a study on maturity in the Old and childishness in the Old Testament, just searching the Hebrew dictionary on my computer, looking for some forms of the word childish, and I kept coming back in Proverbs to. There's no word, by the way, you can find for childishness or immature in the Old Testament. What you find is concepts of being foolish, being a childish, and wise, being mature. In the book of Proverbs, it consolidates it beautifully. And as I went through Proverbs trying to consolidate what a wise man is, in other words, what a mature man is, I discovered these three basic ingredients were part of that definition. So here we are. This is key, folks. Let's zero in and let's study this, look at it, so we know where our teams are supposed to be aimed. Ready? Self-control is the first element of maturity. That's not being ruled by passions, not being ruled by emotions, desires, wishes, or curiosity. It means freedom from having to do what one feels like doing. It's the ability to choose to do what is right. And it fosters selflessness, which is necessary for love of others. Now, let's dwell on this a little. You can tell that a child, a toddler, is immature, is childish, because they do whatever on their mind. A poorly trained or an unfinished trained 2-year-old walks in the door and does whatever they feel like. They wander to the coffee pot. Then they wander to the chair. Then they wander to the cookies. And then they wander to the other refreshment. They give themselves over to doing whatever on their mind to do. If they walked into the church office here, they would open up desk drawers without thinking about it because they're curious. Whereas a mature person would say, no, I do wonder what's in those drawers, but I will restrain myself and not open them. Yet an adult who grows up used to nosing around in people's belongings is really immature, you see. They never learn to say no to themselves. When you're ruled by your passions, your wishes, your curiosity, you're ruled by your craving for self-indulgence, that's immaturity. Sadly, we've got a lot of people growing up today but never reach maturity. A lot of people are they're married now, and yet they lack maturity. They're still ruled by their desire for self-gratification. It rules them. They're not bearing the fruit of the Spirit, self-control. So that's the first goal we have for teenagers, is that they become self-controlled. Not ruled by their passions, wishes, desires, curiosity, etc. Secondly, wisdom. That's understanding. That's insight. It's the ability to learn from experience. It means independence, in that they're able to be independent and not rely always on others to tell them what to do. They learn how to evaluate a situation and know the right thing to do. They have wisdom, you see. Wisdom means the ability to handle stressful problems with a level head. And get this, please, it's only possible for our teens or us to exercise wisdom when we are self-controlled. Self-controlled is a key ingredient here. Because when you're ruled by your passions, you do stupid things. When your passions are ruling you, you'll be foolish. An Old Testament example is Samson. Remember what a fool he was, ruled by his hormones? 3 times Delilah tried to trick him, and 3 times he teased her back and gave her false ways to drain him of his strength. Now, she had tried to take him up on every deception he laid out, and finally, laying in his babe's arms, he looks up and says, okay, you could cut off my hair. Now, wait a second, you're reading along, and you say, Samson, don't, you fool! Come on, man, can't you see what's happening here? Folks, he couldn't see. Why not? His hormones were clouding his thinking. He wasn't self-controlled, so he became foolish in his thinking. When we're not self-controlled, we are not wise. Even the wisest man in the world, other than Christ, Solomon, was foolish because he lacked self-restraint. Marrying 700 wives and 300 concubines, this guy had a problem. Hormones were going, he didn't know how to say no. And he became foolish, and he served false gods. This is the wisest man in the world. You see, it hits anybody. The third ingredient of maturity, responsibility. That means accepting personal accountability for one's own actions. It means faithful and conscientious work habits. It means having integrity, reliability. You know that your teen is growing maturity as they become responsible. The first way is they stop blaming others for their faults and their mistakes. They start owning up. They start confessing. That's maturity. Secondly, you can depend upon them. They are not ruled by their laziness, not ruled by their passions, so that when you leave the home and you say, do such and such, you know when you return, it will be done. That's maturity, right? I mean, what kind of employee loses his job? The one who's immature and ruled by his passions. The boss comes back, the work isn't done, he gets fired because he's not making wise decisions. So let me just say, as we turn the page here, we have about 4 or 5 hours worth of material And so we're not going to be going through everything. So you'll notice we're going to skip some sections tonight. I have to warn you up front, lest you become disappointed at the moment and you begin to cry out against me and whine or something. And if you heard my parenting seminars, you know I cannot reward whining. And we wonder where our kids get it. So what characterizes immaturity and self-indulgence? Well, it's when our teens lack self-control. They're self-indulgent. They rarely say no to themselves. They become self-absorbed. Their self-centeredness so rules them. They think the world revolves around them. They interpret life in terms of themselves. They walk in the room. They are on their own mind. They preoccupy themselves. Somebody could get hurt. Somebody could get damaged, offended, and they thought is how they feel about it. You ever see that the old cartoon? There's a little cartoon character talking about himself, and then he finally says, "Well, I'm talking so much about me. Let's talk to you. Let's change the subject from me." He turns to his friend and says, "So, enough about me. What do you think about me?" Self-absorption characterizes most teenagers today. Most. See, it's not good. It's not just something of faith. Self-absorption is the ultimate height of sin. It's what the Bible calls self-love. It's just at the end times, men shall be lovers of themselves. And so here we are with a generation of young people fostering self-absorption, preoccupation with themselves and self-gratification. So that's a sign of the end times. Men shall be absorbed with themselves. Immaturity means that they lack wisdom. You can read more all of these later. I know there's a temptation to keep pouring through this, but just kind of scan with me. And they're also a self-absorbed young person or adult will be irresponsible. When they sin, they habitually deny their responsibility. Nothing's ever their fault. In fact, they're always victims of other people's failures. They rarely will fess right up and say, "You know, you're right. Gosh, Mom, Dad, I'm so sorry. I did blow it." Immaturity says, "Hey, well, but not me. They're determined to not be wrong." Sign of immaturity. When you confront a someone who's mature, a sign is they're willing to own up. Really, and so that convicts many of us as adults that here we are grown up, but yet we lack that aspect of maturity because whenever we're confronted, we're quick to defend. We're quick to not want to own up. We're quick to blame someone else. It's a sign of immaturity. Sign of irresponsibility. The final consequence, Roman numeral number 5 on your page there. The consequences on page 5 of an indulged, unsubdued will. If our teens are allowed through their youth into their teen years to become self-absorbed and grow in immaturity, well, they come to finally believe that they should have whatever they want, when they want it. They think they shouldn't have to put up with anything they don't like. They feel deprived when they don't get what they want from life. They become preoccupied with their rights, and they know little of personal responsibility. They're frequently angry because they don't get what they think is owed them. And really, they end up being victims. The classic is those who I have dealt with who've been in prison or in jail. Rarely do you meet a man who admits his guilt. In jail, there's someone who was never required to own up. And so now they're incarcerated and they're a victim. They're a victim of that cop who arrested them. And they're going to get that cop because if it wasn't that cop, they wouldn't be in jail. Pardon me? What did they get? It's that cop's fault? Yes, I wouldn't be here if it was he hadn't arrested me. No concept of, I blew it, I'm getting what I deserved. Boy, in fact, I'm getting off easy. But our young people head in that direction. So with this discussion about maturity and setting our goal of that, here's our basis for evaluating parenting decisions. Roman numeral number 6, the basis for evaluating parenting decisions. What would this activity, organization, this relationship, what would this experience foster within our team? Maturity or immaturity? Now, I just want to pause there and kind of make a big exclamation mark, because this is what you would call a tool. Here you are, trying to learn how to make wise decisions for your teens. Well, should they be in soccer? Should they be in youth group? Should they be in youth choir? Should I sign them up for this class? Should they? And you're making these decisions about your teen and what you should love. Should I let them dye their hair blue or pierce their tongue? Which I know, painful, but it's a modern fad that isn't going over real big. But I have seen them with pierced tongues. What will this do? You evaluate it. You say, would this cause them to be mature? Would this feed their sense of self-indulgence? Their self-preoccupation? Will this feed irresponsibility, wisdom? Or will this bring them to maturity? You evaluate it very simply. Any corporation does that. Any church with goals does that. Any organization says, wait, do we want to venture out into this new area? Let's evaluate it in terms of, nope, that won't help us accomplish our goals here. Nope, that has no place in our corporate life. Well, parenting, we do the same thing. Do I want this for my young person? Nope, this won't help them grow in any sense of maturity whatsoever. Mm-mm, not necessary. We can make a decision accordingly. So there's some obstacles, though, to achieving goals of maturity, and here's what they are. Because you may have your sight set on maturity, you may focus in on it, but there's something that's going to hamper you. First, A in your outline, false ideas of maturity will hamper you. These false ideas of maturity means it comes naturally and without training. See, there's a popular thought today that says, oh, just raise your kids in a loving home, give them a good time for as teenagers, make sure they have a happy and fulfilling childhood, and it'll just take place. Everybody matures. Everybody grows up. What's the big deal? It doesn't require any special training. Well, that is a problem. Everybody does grow up, but not everybody matures. I know some 60-year-old men that drive me nuts. They whine. Now, I'll be willing to be driven nuts because I need to be shaped in the image of Christ. So I need those people in my life. They weren't there, I couldn't minister to them. But why is that possible that someone could be 60 years old and whine like an 8-year-old or a 5-year-old? Because they never successfully dealt with life and they were never matured. And so we've got to get this thought from our head that maturity happens naturally. It doesn't. It requires effort and training on our part as parents. And if you look at your teens and say, they're nowhere near being mature, then your training isn't over. Don't say, well, they're teens, I had my shot. No. That's not what the scriptures would say. You haven't had your shot. It's not over. Your job is not finished. Doesn't matter if your son or your daughter is 18. If you can look at them and say, they're not ready for life, then your job of training them hasn't ceased. B, here's another obstacle, which I mentioned a moment ago. The parents have the wrong goal. They say, I want my child to have a happy and fulfilling childhood. A happy and fulfilling childhood is what I want so much for my child. Well, that's the wrong goal. That is what our society is doing today. We've got to raise our children happy and fulfilling. Let me make sure I buy every toy available to them. Let me make sure they have every experience possible. Let me make sure I enroll them in every sports and social program available to them. And we indulge our children, teach them that the world centers around them, and they approach life with a self-absorbed, immature perspective. That destroys and keeps kids immature when we set our sights on making sure they have a happy and fulfilling childhood. Make sure, they're almost a senior in high school. I've got to make sure that they have a happy and fulfilling senior year. You've been very careful and protective, but their senior year, you're kind of releasing them to make sure they have this happy and fulfilling senior experience because they're at the top of the world. They're a senior in high school. I mean that's the pinnacle, isn't it? The pinnacle of life? No. But it's a myth we accept. And it causes us to damage our children and breed immaturity within them. Here's the third obstacle. Accepting variables as absolutes. Now, this is a very general principle, and some of you read my book know what I mean. Accepting variables as absolutes means that you just assume certain things have to be, such as, well, kids need to be involved in the youth choir and the youth group or in soccer or in the teen sports programs or at school in this event, that who says? Well, I mean, but they have to go to school, and who says? Now, my discussion tonight is not on how you educate your kids, but what I'm saying is, and my kids, by the way, play in sports programs, so I'm not coming against them. What I'm trying to get you to do is to reconsider, what are you clinging to? Are you wrongly saying, but they have to have these experiences? Who says? Who says they have to go to youth camp? But it's a Christian camp. Who says? Let's remember the statistics. Some of you know this. Josh McDowell surveyed the evangelical church several years back and discovered that 43% of teens in evangelical youth groups fornicate by the time they reach their 18th birthday. Consider a typical youth group. Typically, 43% of that high school group will have fornicated by the time they reach their 18th birthday. That's almost one out of every two. Well, who do you suppose they're being involved with? The other kids in the youth group. Someone they met at church camp. My point isn't that church camps are bad. My point is, don't think anything's an absolute. The best thing I feel like I've ever done for my church in trying to groom a church that strengthens families is forsake any loyalty to modern tradition. Doctrinally, we're as stable and loyal as you could be. But in modern practice and tradition, I've decided nothing absolutely has to happen. Let's reevaluate our church structure, what we do on Sunday mornings, youth ministries, child care. I won't have loyalty to any modern tradition. We stop as a board counseling and evaluate what it does. If it's productive, if it's unproductive. We throw out many things that are modern traditions because we determined they were damaging the family. All I'm saying here is, folks, that would be a major obstacle in your parenting if you think certain things have to happen. They don't. So I won't tell you what those things are. I'm just asking you to evaluate your parenting and evaluate the things you think your kids have to have. No, they might not. Next, D. Here's another obstacle. When you put your children into situations they lack the moral maturity to handle, they will never be mature. Then it won't reach that goal if you put them into situations they're unable to handle morally. We'll talk about how you evaluate their moral maturity in a little bit. But the bottom line is, there's some parents saying, well, you got to do it. I mean, the whole youth group, they're having a lock-in. You ever heard of a lock-in? It's when the high school group gets together and they all get locked in to a room like this, and the youth group is there, and you got 50 or 100 high school kids all spending the night together and locked into this room. And they call it a lock-in. It's done in common in evangelical Christian circles. And because it's sponsored by the church, parents say, well, the church is doing it. I mean, they wouldn't do it if it wasn't good. I mean, you know that youth pastor, he's really dynamic. He's double the size of the youth group. This is one of the things he does to do it. But what if they lack the moral maturity to handle it? What if it's not truly a login? What if that your 17-year-old son gets a kick, gratified by having the privilege of sleeping on the floor and sleeping next to the 17 other girls in the group? See what I'm saying? What if there's some element of sexual gratification here and they're not touching? Just the privilege of sleeping with other girls. You ever think about this? What if they lack the moral maturity to handle it? There's a level of familiarity you enjoy by sleeping with the opposite sex. Just in safe sleeping bags, fully chaperoned. You follow what I'm saying here. You will damage your children if you keep putting them in situations that lack the moral maturity to handle. Next. E on your outline. Here's another obstacle. Accepting teenage rebellion as natural and unavoidable. It is common to this century only, primarily to America, and teenage rebellion is actually also common to other nations that we infect. Generally, they're the less affluent nations. The nations that are more backward, that is less affluent, less civilly or socially as advanced, their young people continue to mature quickly. Nations like ours have young people that are full of rebellion and defiance, we think it's normal. So those are the goals we've been discussing. We're now to our second point. Let's move directly into session two. Now we're at family roles. The family is an organization. The family, in fact, is the very first organization that God ever created. Look at your notes here, but there's no need for transparency for this page. An organization typically has, get this, goals, roles, and rules of operation. Goals, roles, and rules. If you'd like to remember it, it's G-R-R. All right, just remember. G-R-R. Goals, roles, and rules of operation. So, point A. Within the organization of the family, he organized it. He gave goals. We've talked about some of those. Roles. Husbands are the heads of the homes. Their job as leader requires them to assume responsibility for the administration, provision, protection of their families. You'll notice that I did not print out all the references on your page. I was about half the Old Testament and portion of the New it would have required. Multiple references to the heads of homes. God caused husbands to be that. Now, we're talking of headship here, not meaning dominance. As we discussed at the marriage role session we did the other night. Not a picture of dominance, but a picture of assuming responsibility, unloading stress and responsibility off of wives so the wives can be carefree and happy. And that's the picture of headship. B, we see under God's roles for wife, the wife's job was created to follow her husband, follow his leadership, and function as his assistant. Now, in case this is confusing or even distressing for you, maybe get the tapes from Sunday night. Because we don't have time. I'm just laying out here the foundation. So the wife's job, she has a function, a job, her role. Thirdly, they have roles as parents then. The job of the husband and wife is to bring children to maturity. Their role is physical, emotional, mental, and spiritual maturity. This means they oversee the children's education, training, and discipline. I've laid out a number of passages here that emphasize this role they have as the trainers, as the educators, as the disciplinarians, as the protectors of their children, the provider. It goes on and on. I've just listed a sampling here for you. B. So that's the parent's role. Fourth, the children's job is to follow the parents and cooperate with their leadership and training. Yeah, it is actual role. This means, let's just stop a moment. In a job, if you lack a job description, you will be frustrated. If you were hired and you stood there and you saw the first day of the job, you weren't sure what to do, and you said, well, I'll start doing something. So you start shuffling through paperwork on a desk. Your boss might come up and rebuke you, straighten you out. What are you doing? You're not doing your job. Why did we hire you? And you say, but no one's giving me a job description. You would be frustrated because there would be expectations on you, and you weren't sure what they were. Supposed to provide for and care for and love and do good spiritual stuff for our children, but we've never really stopped to evaluate their roles. Well, we're going over those roles tonight. But the children, do you know that, I don't know how many of you have ever done this. Have you ever taken, looked at your children and said, here is your role. Here is my, I am the trainer. You are the trainee. You have one primary purpose in life. It is to look at me and receive training. And when I give you the training, you should look at me and say, oh, thank you, most honorable parent. Thank you for training me and equipping me for the future. That should be the appropriate response. But often, you see, our children don't have a clue to what their role is. And no one's ever told them. We just, all they know is they're getting instruction, they're getting input from us. But they don't, they never stop to think. This is their job. And today we had a session for teens. You should see the look on their face when I'm busy telling them that their role, and they're looking at me like, wow, this is mind-blowing. What? You're like this is on a job description? Top line? Follow parents' leadership? Obey them? You mean there's nothing better to do in life than this? This is the first and premier thing I'm called to do? And it doesn't matter what else I accomplish in a day. If I failed in that, I failed in my primary responsibility. You should have seen the looks on their faces. And it was exciting for me, though, because as I was speaking, I was watching many receive this and take it to heart. Well, our children's job is to follow parents. Look at, this is great. In the Ten Commandments, the first four commandments are given to us towards God. Right, regarding not having graven images, worshiping God, Him alone, Him first, not using His name in vain, the Sabbath, all related to God. Then we get, okay, now, commandment five, your responsibility towards people, one another. What's the very first of those? Honor your father and mother. Let's think about this. Wait a second. He's got these intense moral laws here. He's got, don't commit adultery, don't covet, don't steal, don't lie. And out of the blue, honor your father and mother. Folks, that made it into the Big Ten. In fact, that is the number one responsibility of those commandments. This is heavy. This is a key thing we must groom our children with. I mean, I have deep conviction in my heart, conviction, guilt conviction, because as I, in the last several months as I prepared for this, I've realized I do not instruct my children carefully about that commandment. I do not groom them to the great importance God places on that commandment. And so my youngest will have a benefit because I will be working intently to groom this so that they will elevate that to a high place in their life. Their primary role is to be one who lives each day primarily, first off, to honor mother and father. We've got to elevate that to our children so they see it's of high supreme importance. Look at Proverbs 1:8. Solomon speaking to his sons. He says, listen, my son, to your father's instruction and do not forsake your mother's teaching. Proverbs 4:1, listen, my sons, to a father's instruction. Listen. Pay attention. These are adult sons, by the way, he's speaking to. These are teenagers, all right? These are adult sons between the ages of 12 and 30 living at home unmarried. Proverbs 13:1, a wise son heeds his father's instruction. The mocker does not listen to rebuke. Proverbs 23:22, listen to your father who gave you life and do not despise your mother when she is old. Now, he's not just talking in context here about just despising her. He's talking, well, once again, about her instruction. Don't despise her and her influence when she's old. Well, if she's old, that means that the teen has grown old, too. There doesn't come a time when you then begin to despise your mother's instruction. You take it to heart. You honor her supremely. That's enough for that. The children's role is to be a follower of their parents, to cooperate with their leadership. All right, now let's get back to the parents and their roles. Roman numeral number 2. The parent as director, controller. God has called parents to lead their children. They're the leaders of the home. Are you ready? God gives leadership direction through parents to children. He gives leadership direction to children through parents. And that doesn't, see, I used to for years interpret the fifth commandment to be children honor your parents, meaning you obey them morally and their moral commandments. You comply with them. But we're talking about life decisions here. You'll find that in the scriptures, the parents were actively involved in their children's lives, giving leadership to them and direction until the time they were married. So if their youth, their teen years, the parents have the authority and responsibility to direct their children's lives up to that point when they got married. That the scriptures consider children under their parents' jurisdiction for that period. And it was only in the establishing of a new household that the parent's authority leaves off. And the new authority begins. Then a young man's become an authority and his wife is under his authority, you see. So the parent, as director, controller, gives leadership direction to the children. Be on that, under that. Parents are responsible to control their children's behavior, no matter what age. Oh, yes. Parents are responsible to control. Now, this is scary because there are some people who say, but wait a second. All the experts I know and love have said that if you try to control your children's behavior as teenagers, they'll go in rebellion. You know what? They may. We may have, as parents, have accidentally given their children the wrong impression. They granted them parental authority. And then when we try to take it back, they'll rebel against it because they're resistant to yielding that authority that we've granted them all these years. but we were wrong to release them from our control. We'll talk about how we regain authority, regain control in our children's lives as teenagers. And it is possible, and it is necessary. Parents are responsible to control their children's behavior, no matter what age they are. Here's their example. Exodus 21:17 says, anyone who curses his father or mother must be put to death. Now, that's in the Old Testament law, so we're not under that Old Testament civil law. But it does tell you something about God's mind. God created a law. It says it is so supremely important that children honor their parents, act in a respectful and honorable fashion towards their parents, that those who do not are to be put to death. Just imagine if that were still the case even that day. One kid amongst, where's Ishmael? Where's Caleb? Oh, they were stoned to death over the weekend, huh? Said harsh words to their parents. Oh, and then from that day forward, you can tell the rest of the teenagers, oh, yes, honorable mother. Whatever you say, most beautiful among women. I speak, I'll obey. Oh, you are the most wonderful parents a child can have. God didn't put up with anything. He says, you speak dishonorably, you will die. That's heavy. But that's the supreme importance he places upon it. Leviticus 29:20, verse 9. If anyone curses his father or mother, he must be put to death. He has cursed his father or his mother, and his blood will be on his own head. Deuteronomy 21, verses 18 to 21 says that if parents find their son is stubborn or rebellious, they're to bring him before the elders, and that son is to be stoned to death. If they find they cannot control him, they work. But we'll get the reason. It says that the evil is to be purged from Israel. God considered that children like this were a stain, an infection within Israel. And that's the way it goes. Okay, that's Old Testament. Let's consider New Testament. 1 Timothy chapter 3, verses 4 through 5. Reading about qualifications for elders, it says, one that ruleth well his own home. In other words, one is qualified to be an elder if he rules his own house well, has his children in subjection with all gravity, with all seriousness. Sobriety. They take their father seriously. For if a man doesn't know how to rule his own house, how can he take care of God's church? In other words, the proof that a man is qualified to be a pastor, to be an elder within the congregation, is that he knows how to keep his own home under control, that his children will obey him. Doesn't mean that his children won't need discipline, that his children won't need training. It just means that his children will not live wild and unruly lives. They will not be living in sin. But my point here is, and God's point, is not that elders have a higher standard. See, elders don't have a higher standard. They simply must live the normal Christian standard. This tells us that God wants all of us to have our children under control, including our teenagers, our young adults living at home. Titus 1:5 says, an elder must be a man whose children believe and are not open to the charge of being wild and disobedient. Well, this brings us to a question. At what age must children reach before parents are no longer responsible to control them? Well, I've alluded to that already. In fact, I said it very directly. Our children should be required to obey us as long as they are under our jurisdiction. That is the time they are ready, until either we've had to kick them out of the home or they've gone on to establish their own home as a husband or as a wife. And here's the proof in the Old Testament. Now, this is important, especially for those of you who might be thinking, but wait a second, once they reach the teen years, we're supposed to back off, release control, and then you're not supposed to be controlling them anymore, because that's, wait a second, who says? Who's setting these ideas? We're going to look at the Scriptures. We're going to see what godly parents did in the Bible. Let us set aside our preconceived ideas that may be damaging our children, and let us look to the Word and learn. This is one of the occasions. So let's look. Let's go with an open heart and mind. 1 Samuel chapter 3, it's right there on your page, verses 13 and 14, we see that Eli, who was the priest of Israel, was lost the priesthood for his family line because he failed to control the behavior of his grown sons. Some of you know the story. His sons worked with him as assistant priests. It says they were fornicating with some of the young ladies who came to work within the temple servants. Eli, knowing this was wrong, went to them and rebuked them. God came along, ultimately says, because you only rebuked them and you didn't restrain them, therefore, Eli, you're going to lose your whole lineage. You're no longer going to be the priest. You're being demoted. A man's identity was his career, if you will. And here he was, the high priest of Israel, and he's told, you're going to lose it for yourself and your children. How devastating. All because of one thing. He did not control his sons. He allowed them to live in sin and did nothing about it except rebuke them. 1 Samuel chapter 8, verse 3, we see that Samuel also, who took Eli's place, Samuel also lost the priesthood for his own family. Why? The same thing. He failed to control his young adult sons. They could have been in their 20s. This is something. A father was considered to be responsible to control the sinful lifestyles of his children? You bet. 1 Kings chapter 1, we see that David was held responsible for the rebellion of his son, Adonijah. In Deuteronomy 22, verses 20 and 21, we see that a young lady who's married off by her father is discovered by her new husband, the groom, that she's not a virgin. It says that he takes her to the elders, it proves, or whatever proof they have, that she wasn't a virgin, and that she is to be stoned to death on her father's front porch, basically. Now, she's killed for having been a fornicator, but why is her father? He's got to live with the reproach of her failure to be chaste, because it was his job to make sure she was chaste. You see, he was to have his daughter under his control. I read that. It woke me up about a year and a half ago. I read that. I began studying, thinking, what am I doing? Could potentially sending my daughter off in situations where she could be defiled in some fashion. It caused me to tighten up on the level of risk I take with my daughter. Under Old Testament law, which we're not under, I remind you of that, but under Old Testament law, God's mind was a father was 100% responsible, or at least 90% responsible, for his daughter's lack of purity. What if she'd snuck out of the house? He couldn't control it, right? Apparently, God says he was still responsible, perhaps for not passing on the right values to his daughter. In Luke chapter 2, verse 51, New Testament now, we see Jesus, when he was 12 years old, left the temple with his parents. Remember, he'd been dialoguing with the priests and the elders there. It says when he left there, he says he was subject unto them. Well, 12 was an adult. So it says as a young adult now, he looked at his parents and went on with them. And it says, the implication is from that day forward, he lived in subjection to their authority. This means perfect Jesus, who never did anything wrong, didn't need correction, yet still he was receiving commands and direction for his life from his parents. It says, and he lived in subjection to their authority. He lived obedient to them. He received input from them. Now, when he was 30 years old, 30 was an age of maturity. You were considered an adult at 12. At 30, you were considered to have lived life enough that you were mature enough now to begin public ministry. And that's why he waited till he was 30. If he had been 29 years of age trying to minister, the Pharisees would have had a very good reason to reject him. They had no good reasons after he was 30. But he waited till he was that qualified age. My point, though, is here he was, a young adult from the age 12 to the time he was 30, living at home, obedient to his parents. Luke chapter 15, verse 11, the prodigal son takes off. I'd like to point out something to you. Everybody cites the prodigal son as this rebellious wild kid who takes off. He was obedient to his father. He says, Father, I would like to run away from home. Is that okay with you? In fact, would you subsidize my departure? You ever really think about this? He solicits permission from his father. So he's still, in a sense, he wants to leave home, but he wants his father's blessing to go. I'd like my inheritance. I'd like what would be mine to establish my own household. I'd like it now. And the father says, okay, I can't stop you here. And he gives him money. He finances his departure. So here we have a young man rebelling, but who still had the proper concept, a young adult living at home, under his father's authority. He returns home, the father throws him a big party, and the older son says, wait a second, Dad, I've been with you all these years, and I have living obedient to you. There in Luke 15, verse 29. Living obedient to you. Young adult living home, living obedient to his father. Well, folks, I want to move on, but take to heart. I believe it's very, very clear. Teenagers are to be under our control, and you are not wrong. In fact, you are right to assert strong parental authority. You must, following the Old and New Testament example. There are more. I just pulled out some nuggets for you, some just simple illustrations of those young adults living at home who are obedient to their parents and whose parents were held accountable to keep them under control. Now, this is still scary to some of you. Right now, you're immediately thinking, oh, boy, my kids wouldn't put up with that. They thought they're being defiant, they're rebellion. There's going to be, I go home and try to tell them what they can and can't do now. There's going to be a war breakout. I better call the paramedics in advance before I get there. Wait, put your mind on rest. We've got some more biblical solutions to use. But I'm just establishing the foundation here. God does give you authority and doesn't just give you permission to control your teenage children. He gives you other obligation. You must. Let's move on. Now, D on your outline. Now, from this point, we will be skipping some things. So bear with me as we skim a few points. D on your outline, there's a modern approach, which I call non-restrictive parenting. And basically, it says, let teens make all or most of their own decisions. Limit or eliminate parental input. And don't force your values on them. This is kind of, it's written right there on your notes. This is the idea. This is not a biblical idea. Now, there's some wisdom in that when our teens, our young people become teens, they need to be entrusted with greater and greater responsibility, granted more opportunities to make more decisions, granted some chances to fail. You have to risk some element with your teens. However, this modern concept of non-restrictive parenting means that because they're a teenager, even though they've not proven themselves faithful or capable or anything, just simply because they're at that age, you release them. You let them go. You can't hold back. I've had people tell me, and my wife before, says, you're hurting your children. You're exercising such control, still not releasing them. You're going to damage them, they'll say. Where do they get these ideas? Not in the Scriptures. Scripture says a parent has that authority. This non-restrictive parenting, though, is very popular and invasive. And I would suggest that perhaps some here have without realizing it, have been sharing in some of those ideas and perhaps influencing or implementing them. But you will reap what you sow if this occurs. Point E. Let me put up this next point for you. Point E, if you neglect your responsibility to exercise strong authority over your children, you will reap negative consequences. And look at the multiple examples I've given there. In Judges chapter 2, we see that parents did not intensely control their children. We see that the children grew up as rebellious idol worshippers in Judges chapter 2, verse 10 and 11. In Proverbs 29:15, we're told that the parents who don't exercise firm discipline see their children end up failing to be trained in maturity and godliness. In Proverbs 29, verse 15 also, and also chapter 10, verse 1, chapter 17, verses 21 and 25, these indicate that children who are not controlled fail to learn self-control, which then brings to the family grief, bitterness, and disgrace, the Bible says. So if you fail to exercise firm control over your children, those under your jurisdiction, young and old alike, they will bring grief, bitterness, and disgrace. You know what the hard thing is? Some of you know what I mean. Because you're already there. Or either that or you know someone and you look at the hurt in that family. You see the bitterness. You see the disgrace. You see the shame that they live with. And when you track it back to the point where that young one was not controlled. Proverbs 13:24, parents who withhold strong discipline says do to their children such a disservice that it's as though they hate them. They're hurting their kids by not saying no. Say, well, what can I do? I need to let them go. You can't hold them forget. Force your values on these kids. They've got to own their own. So it's time to back off. But the Bible says you fail to exercise firm discipline, it says you hate your child. Say, no, I love them. No. Who's right? You or the Bible? The Bible says you hate them if you've failed to exercise firm discipline. It's not that you have bitterness towards your child. It means that you're doing them such a disservice, it's as though you're hating them. Well, there's more. They're on your notes. Please look them up later. We won't go over every single one. F. Do teens become mature by being granted full authority over their lives, which is the most the philosophy we're working with and that many of us perhaps have been infected by? Do teens become mature by being granted full authority over their lives? Is that how they're going? All right, here you are. You're 14 now. Time to start making decisions. Time to start learning from life. Oh, and you look at you and your spouse, look at each other and say, oh, this is a tough decision, but time to release them. They're 13 or they're 16 or they're 17, whatever this magic age that you've come up with. Let's just release them, and I call it the sink or swim method. This sink or swim approach does not produce maturity. It doesn't. Saying, go have at it, make all your own decisions. No, it will probably create a lot of independence. Independence from the family. They're going to say, I will do what's gratifying to me. I think I will choose to be with my friends more than my family. Oh, what? A family picnic this Sunday? Too late. I scheduled a tennis date, and I'm going to be hanging out at so-and-so's house. Sorry. Okay, well, you're making your own decisions now. No. Yeah, it'll create independence, all right, but not maturity. In fact, usually granting your child freedom to make all their own decisions before they're ready to, point two, feeds immaturity. It creates greater sense of self-indulgence. Why do you suppose our teenagers today are so self-absorbed? Because they've been granted, many families have accidentally granted liberty to make decisions to a self-absorbed young person, and they became more self-indulged. And they begin to think that the world revolves around them. They become indignant when they don't get what they want. They can't believe it. How dare you forbid me from doing it? You know, I have rights, they say. See, it's feeding immaturity. And we thought it was doing a good thing. No, they'll grow up self-absorbed, self-indulged, and independent from you. Not self-reliant, independent from you. Well, some of you are perhaps asking the question I posed on point G. Well, should a parent exercise the same level of control over his teens as he does his younger children? No, you don't. Not the same level of control, but some kind of control. You need to begin granting some liberty. And here's I've laid this out on your outline for you. Our teens must have opportunities to fail. Unlike our four-year-old, which we don't give them any chances to fail, our teens should have some chances. However, the consequences we want our teens to learn from, in other words, if they make a mistake, get this, they should be non-moral consequences. You don't say, well, sure, you can go spend the night at so-and-so's house, and you say to your spouse, you know, I don't know, their friend is, I've questioned, I've heard that, you know, they carry condoms in their pocket at all times. I don't know if this is really a good friend or not. But what are you going to do? We got to release them. You know, they have to learn sometime. No, you don't risk your child's moral well-being. If you have doubts, don't do it. You must risk, but you risk non-moral ones. Here's some examples on your page there. Things like mismanaging money. It's a tough one for me as a father to look at my teenagers and see that they're going to waste money. They'll waste money sometimes. And one of my kids wanted to invest in some athletic equipment that was expensive. He'd worked hard for this money, and I counseled against it. I advised it wasn't wise. Now, a year later, he says, oh, gosh, I wish I could sell it. Gosh, what a mistake that was. But he can't sell it. The store they bought it from, who sells used equipment and buys it, doesn't want it. So he's stuck with a lot of it. But I had to let him make that mistake. He's got to learn. How about staying up too late and reaping exhaustion? I don't give my oldest kids bedtimes anymore, generally. My oldest ones, once they reach teen years, and I let them make that decision. I based it on just a bit of counsel I got from the man once. He says he grew up on a farm, and his dad looked at him one night, and he said, Dad, can I stay out late tonight? He says, son, from now on, the son was about 16, you can pick your own bedtime. I only have one rule, that you be up at 5:30 ready to do your chores like normal. So the First time that fellow stretched it. He was in at 1 in the morning. 5:30 roll around, though, he was out of bed and he was dead to the world. He learned his lesson. He could barely find his way through his chores. See, he learned his lesson. So he started picking a reasonable bedtime. He became self-grooming. But there was no moral danger involved, you see. It was just simply a natural consequence. It didn't involve him morally. Allow your kids, perhaps, to become overcommitted to too many people. Counsel them, warn them, but let them get in over their head. Let them learn a lesson. Maybe if they leave their bike out, let them risk losing it. My dad did that to me. It was the best thing he ever did. He warned me not to leave my bike out in the driveway. One morning I came out, it was gone. He stole it himself, and he hid it in the neighbor's garage. I spent 6 hours that day riding a friend's bike up and down the street, looking in the garages, looking in bushes, trying to find. I scoured in the neighborhood. At the end of the day, I was so discouraged. And Flores, I says, well, if you'd listened to my counsel, this wouldn't have happened. Yeah. So he pulls it out of the back room. I was delighted, but I never left it in the front yard again. You should see me come home and find my kid's bike in the front yard. It only happened once. Let your kid risk losing something, maybe assuming a new responsibility at church or school or someplace outside. Let them maybe get stretched. Don't always wake them up. Require them to set their own alarm. And if they're late for school, they mislead through their alarm, don't drive them. Our son had a commitment one day, and he slept through his alarm. And he assumed we would just drive them. I said, sorry. You could call the bus, find out where the schedule is. But, of course, it was a one-mile walk just to the bus stop. And then once by the time he got to where he needed to be, he was 2 hours late, and the bus only took him a mile from where, so he had to walk another mile. You think he slept through his alarm again? Mm-mm. But if we had taken him, what would he have learned? That mom and dad will bail him out. Allow your children to reap consequences, but natural ones, not moral ones, until you're convinced they've demonstrated some level of strength against it. Well, how do your teens gain greater freedom? How do your teens gain greater freedom? We're going to go through this section, this final one, H in your outline, then we're going to take a break, just so that you know what's coming up here. You see, there are many who don't understand when you decide to risk with your teens or to give them a greater privilege. They think, by virtue of being 13, by virtue of being 15, whatever, that they just should have this privilege. Not so. There's a biblical principle I'm going to lay out for you. It's wonderful. It's a classic little biblical nugget. We'll get to it in a moment. Here's the first thing that you and I need to know as parents. Liberty is a privilege. It is not a right. Liberty is a privilege. It isn't a right. Your teens and you tend to think in terms of often, well, it's a right. I mean, they're a teen. They've got their own life to live. And they'll say to you, Mom, Dad, hey, it's my life you're messing with here. This is my life. No, it's the Lord's life. And he's entrusted your life to us. It's not your life. It's the Lord's life. And you're entrusted to our care. So we're going to exercise our parental authority, our parental prerogative. You see, liberty is a privilege they earn. Don't let them, my goodness, I've only got one teen life to live, and you're robbing me of all the pleasure of my teen years by not preventing me to go to this dance or this experience or this event or participate in this program, this activity, this sport. You're robbing. Liberty is a privilege that you earn. When you earn it, you deserve it, you get it. It is not a right. So number one, this is how they gain greater freedom as teens. Just simply first require that they demonstrate maturity. Number one, they've got to demonstrate maturity. In other words, as they demonstrate self-control, wisdom, personal responsibility, faithfulness to the duties, well, then you say, well, you've won this. Because what have they done? They've won your trust, you see. I look at my kids sometimes and just say, please win my trust. I'm leaving you now in care of your little brother and sister. I'm going out. The fridge has a certain level of food in it. We'd like it to be the same level when we get home. And I will look at them in the eye and they say, win my trust, will you? I'm trusting you. Live up to my trust. Give them a standard. Kids want to be trusted. We look at our kids and say, when you're 16, there's nothing in the Constitution of the United States or in the Bible that says you're owed a driver's license. Driving is a privilege. It is a privilege, the government says, but more than that, your parents say. Your parents say, you will drive when you have demonstrated responsibility and maturity. So it could be you'll be 17 or 18 before you get your license. Some kids say, well, at 18, I don't need your permission. Say, not according to the law, but according to the Bible, you do. There's no magic 18 age. Where'd we get this idea? 18, I'm an adult. No, at 13, you're an adult, according to the Bible. But that didn't change my authority over you. Don't think at 18, now you have the right. No, God never granted that right. That's a U.S. custom. There's no biblical mandate. This is 18, some magical adult age. And suddenly you're released and can do what you want. No, so I have no problem looking at my kids and saying, you may be 18 before you get your license. Win it. It's a thrill for me to have my son, who's 17, have a license. Boy, it takes a load off. I used to plead with him, please win this one. You could save your mom and I trips to the store and errands. Oh, you'll have to unload all kinds. Please win my trust. We want you to have your license. Win it. So we're thrilled. He has a license. But we didn't give it to him when he turned 16. In fact, he was nearly 17. So first, they must demonstrate maturity before they gain a privilege. Second, they must demonstrate a submissive, respectful attitude to their parents' authority. Submissiveness to parents, respectful of authority. A child who I say no to, if they act defiant and upset and furious, they're not going to get the privilege. In fact, occasionally, you know what I do with my kids? I'll just say no, knowing that I want to say yes, but I'll say no just to test them. And then, if they act humble, okay, all right, thanks, anyway. Then I might say, well, you know what? I think I will. What? Yeah, you had such a humble attitude before my authority. It made me, I think I will grant you this. Now, they catch on if you do it too often. So you can only do it occasionally, but I'll still do it randomly. I'll say no just to test their, just to see how humble they are before my authority. If they're defiant, I'll look and I say, you know, the fact that you're defiant and resistant to my authority right now confirms that you shouldn't have that liberty. Because I grant liberty to my children who are respectful before my authority. Ooh, what a catch, you know? What a trick. It's not a trick. It's a wise exercise of mental authority. Now, here's the biblical principle that this is based on. All this is rooted in. Ready? In Matthew 25:21, Luke 16:10, Luke 19:17, we learn this principle. Those who prove faithful in little win for themselves the opportunity to be entrusted with much. If you're faithful in little, you're granted or entrusted with much. This is a great little principle for us as believers, as parents. Just tell your child. You want more? Be faithful to the little I give you. You know what, kids? I've discovered that every time we've done something, we've left home, and you've shown yourself faithful. I think we'd like to start granting you more privilege. Wonderful. What a delight. See, they win greater and greater responsibility by being faithful. I did a test with my kids recently. The test was this. I was invited to speak at two different places. I was had to do a men's retreat in San Diego in Southern California. And at the same time, Bakersfield had an event going on. So I couldn't go to Bakersfield, but I was able to send a book table. But I thought, how could that be? And it occurred to me, wait, my kids helped me at my booth. They know what to do. So I had my secretary arrange reserve a hotel, and I reserved a booth space to make some materials available for the people at that conference. And I said to my son, who was 16 at the time, who had his license, just was in the verge of getting his license, and my daughter, I said, if you prove yourselves faithful, by the time that date rolls around, I'll have you go down there, represent me. You'll drive. It's a five-hour drive from our home. If you can take that 5 hours, we'll entrust you with the family van. You fill it with the materials. You go down there, check into the hotel, set up, make the materials available, pack up, and come on home. I mean, that's a major risk. My wife looking at me, are you sure? You want to risk this? It was not easy for me. I was nervous. In fact, I was in San Diego. I had my cell phone out. I said, kids, you take your mom's cell phone. So I'm calling them about every hour. How's it going, kids? I'm checking it. Everything going smooth? Yep, Dad, everything's fine. Oh, you checked into the hotel okay? Just fine, Dad. See, I didn't completely let loose here, but I had to risk. But they had to win it. And as a parent, I was pleased to come back. I stood up the next day in church and say, folks, I've reached a certain pinnacle of joy as a parent here. My children successfully, 16 and 15 years old, made this journey and did the whole... I was thrilled. I'm still thrilled. And I had to look at them and say, kids, you pulled this one off. What's to say I can't send you off on a plane next time? Look, oh, yeah? Yeah, maybe send you off out of state on a plane. You go, you do... Like, oh, Dad, that would be faithful a little. You'd be entrusted with much. Oh, I like that rule, Dad.
This concludes the information on Side 2. This tape was acquired from Family Ministries. Their mailing address is P.O. Box 1412 in Fair Oaks, California, zip 95628. They also have an 800 telephone number. You can call 1-800-545-1229. God bless you now. Bye.